Milicia, Fernando said, still staring.
Militia?
Harrigan asked. Poor slums with their own militia? Jesus Christ, what was going on down here? Fernando shook his head and met Harrigan's eyes.
Drug lords, they run all the favelas.
Harrigan nodded.
Okay, well, we have to get up to where the predator is. Can you still take me?
Fernando stared back at the bodies and nodded.
There's nothing we can do for them,
Harrigan said, stepping toward the entrance to the continuation of the climbing walkway across the square.
Come on,
he motioned to Fernando. Fernando crossed himself like the traditional Catholic he was, then forced his eyes to Harrigan and hurried to join him, resuming the climb. They ducked under laundry lines filled with linens and clothes, dodging through more small squares, climbing even as it sounded like the world was exploding above them. Fernando said nothing. He just led the way, and Harrigan followed, weapon at the ready. A few scared women and children rushed past them, headed down. At times, the passage was so narrow, either the runners or Harrigan and Fernando would have to stop, press themselves against a wall, and wait for the others to pass. No one said anything. It was all in the eyes. As soon as they were clear, each party continued on their mission, racing as fast as they could. And then, as they rounded a curve, plaster and wood exploded beside them as a stream of bullets struck a building, then raked across the pathway. They halted, shrinking back against the wall and waiting, and Harrigan moved into the lead, motioning for Fernando to stay back as he moved cautiously, sliding along toward the corner to grab a peek. There were four men armed with assault weapons, two AK-47s and Imbel IA-2s of local make, using what cover they could and yelling back and forth as they fired toward a rooftop a level or two higher. Their bursts of automatic fire were met with streams from an invisible laser cannon exploding against buildings, cement, and other objects around them. The Predator was cloaked, but his red triangular targeting laser appeared and highlighted its targets, causing many to panic, confused. Who was the enemy assaulting them? They did their best to aim in the direction of the laser fire, but the Predator kept moving quickly, each burst coming from some new position, and the four men were hopelessly beaten, even if they couldn't accept that. Then, one by one, they were hit, their chests highlighted by a red dot before the laser tore holes through them. From behind his cloak, the Predator laughed or clicked, and Harrigan heard the familiar sound of hydraulics as its laser cannons honed in on one target at a time. Occasionally branches would bend as the creature leapt between them, or dust flew from clattering tiles, marking its movements. Each time, the survivors' fire became more and more desperate as they sprayed the rooftops and surrounds, spinning, eyes desperately searching for the target. The first three screamed as they died, their chests smoking as they fell. Their companions' panic grew with each fallen comrade, and then he was alone, and a thump came from behind him. The man whirled, aimed his imbel, but then the Predator was on him, a spear slamming through his chest as he gasped, its tip poking out the front as blood flooded. The man tried to stay on his feet, stumbling, even as his weapon fell. Then his neck tore open as an invisible knife pulled across it, and he collapsed.
Mius,
Fernando whispered from beside Harrigan, where he'd sneaked up to get a peek. Then there was a shimmer and a buzz as the Predator uncloaked, his full, ugly, green-spotted, dreadlocked mass appearing before them. The Predator bent to retrieve its treasures, quickly scalping the latest victim and grabbing his weapon as Harrigan flashed back to memories of his previous confrontations. Fernando gasped loudly.
A monster! Cristo Jesus!
The Predator chittered and whirled, alert and staring right toward them, even as its laser cannon servos whirred and took aim.
Get back!
Harrigan shouted, reaching back to pull Fernando behind the wall, even as he heard a whistle growing in volume, and the ground near the Predator's feet exploded.
Take that, you son of a bitch!
Garber shouted and moved into view along a rooftop to the east, aiming a grenade launcher with laser sights, the red dot lighting up the Predator's chest. And then the world exploded again as Garber and the Predator unleashed their hellfire on each other. Harrigan grabbed Fernando and threw him to the ground as fire swallowed the air above them. Coughing from more concrete dust and thick smoke, Fernando mourned his blouse wasn't likely to survive this insanity. When he tried to get up, Harrigan smacked him back down again. Carefully, Harrigan rose to a crouch to get a better view of the fight without losing his head. He stunk of sweat and fear, a scent Fernando had become intimately familiar with in the favela. Except Fernando's fear dissipated as he stared up at the crouching retired policia. His mouth dropped in a small O as he took in the white dust smeared across Harrigan's face. His forehead glistened with sweat and blood, and a gun was clutched firmly at his side. He looked like an action movie star. And action movie stars needed bigger guns. Lots of big guns. Scooching back on the ground before getting up, Fernando then whistled at Harrigan.
"Hey, you want more guns like crazy down there?"
Harrigan's head swiveled around to look at Fernando, but his gaze was unseeing, almost haunted. Fernando saw the monster too, but he could question reality and cry like a hysterical baby later. He sternly reminded himself the favela overflowed with hidden and not-so-hidden monsters. You learned quick not to stop and stare when you found one. He locked eyes with the ex-cop.
"Say hello to my little friend, eh?"
Harrigan's brow creased, and his eyes flickered with understanding.
"Rapido, Harrigan!"
Fernando cried and took off running, just as the building next to them shuddered violently. Laser bolts and gunshots flew overhead. Apparently, neither the monster nor the crazy guy below was dead yet.
"Guns. Yeah, yeah, I'd like more guns,"
Harrigan said, still distracted but following Fernando now. Daintily stepping over a couple of bloody, decapitated bodies and into a shack twice the size of any near it, Fernando raced around looking for weapons. Harrigan watched skeptically.
"What makes you think there are guns in here?"
"Because,"
Fernando said, exasperated, still not having found them.
"The drug lord always has guns, lots of guns."
A flicker of an idea practically lit up over his head, and Fernando ran to the small attached bathroom.
"Yoo-hoo!"
he called to Harrigan, pleasure evident in his voice. Harrigan barely fit into the bathroom alongside Fernando. The rusted-out bathtub overflowed with guns. Big damn guns. AK-47s, Heckler & Koch MR-762 models of various types, shotguns, even a few Uzis and other machine guns. Boxes of ammo shoved in stacks wherever they fit around them. Harrigan greedily gathered up several AK-47s, two Agent Ks, and an Uzi, but nearly dropped them. Fernando followed his fixation to where the bloodless face was now revealed in the center of the tub. Someone was dead and buried under the guns. Picking up a handgun with his forefinger and his thumb, Fernando said,
"Yeah, don't mind him. He was already here."
Then he gingerly placed the gun back on the pile.
"I'm a lover, not a fighter."
Thoroughly strapped with semi-automatic weapons, pockets bursting with ammo, and a sawed-off shotgun slung over his shoulder, Harrigan started back for the war zone. Fernando grabbed his arm to stop him, having second thoughts.
"What if you die? How will I get to the City of Angels?"
"If either of us are going to get to the City of Angels,"
Harrigan jerked his head to the outside,
"we'll have to go through hell first."
Fernando clapped excitedly.
"Oh, I think I have seen your film."
Harrigan shook his head before running back, Fernando close on his heels. They found the big crazy one shooting a stream of fire out from a flamethrower. The Predator had thrown up some kind of invisible shielding, but had weakened his own invisibility. Fernando gaped as large chunks of the alien flickered in and out of visibility. The alien gave a high-pitched shriek of anger as it felt the heat of the firepower. The top of the slum was exploding with gunfire, detonations, flying debris, and noise as Harrigan led Fernando back along a winding pathway, climbing, searching for a good location to get a bead on the deadly Predator. Men shouted, screamed, and bullets whizzed, filling the air.
"Come on, motherfucker! Is that the best you got?"
Garber shouted and sneered as he launched another grenade, then sent a laser-guided stream of automatic fire in its wake, straight toward where the alien had been crouching moments before. A wall exploded and fell, the roof caving in. No sign of the fast-moving foe. It was all too familiar. Harrigan's memory flashing back to images of Los Angeles. Gang wars, the streets, Leon Cantrell, Danny Archuleta, Jerry Lambert, even his old Captain Pilgrim. Archuleta and Lambert had been killed by a predator in L.A. years ago, during Harrigan's last encounter with one. Now, countless others were adding to the predator's body count. In front of him, a wall exploded, a thatched roof caving in, accompanied by the screams of a woman and children, an infant crying. Harrigan fought the urge to run in and rescue them. It wasn't safe. He couldn't do anyone good buried in wreckage. Drug dealers with grizzled faces bearing various stages of facial hair screamed in Portuguese, firing their AK-47s, Uzis, and sawed-off shotguns at the fast-eluding alien, now cloaked again in the barely visible, vibrating haze. But Harrigan knew what to look for. His trained eyes multitasked, searching the mountainside for both an ideal sniper position and the alien foe at the same time. There he is, over in that palm tree, moving to a new position. He was tempted to call out, but knew his warnings would be too late every time, if anyone even heard them over all the noise. Instead, he ran faster, dodging, ducking, and diving for cover whenever the explosions or bullets came too close. As long as he and Fernando stayed hidden and in shadows, as long as other aggressors took the alien's focus, they'd be safe. Predators targeted prey who fought back with only occasional innocents caught in the crossfire. They were about the sport of it, and killing unarmed innocents wasn't sporting on their planet either. Like his foes, the Predator kept firing off a steady stream of laser fire, his red triangular laser sights the only indication of his location, along with hand-thrown bombs of some sort. Occasionally, Harrigan thought he could pick out a familiar chittering chirp, but each time he turned to look, the beast had moved on. "Look out!" Fernando shouted fruitlessly from behind Harrigan as the corner where Garbra just fired from exploded into a cloud of dust, debris, and orange and yellow flashes.
"Fuck me!"
Garbra yelled, but somehow he was still standing, face blackened when the smoke cleared, even as he raced for a new position.
"Holy God!"
Harrigan muttered as Fernando crossed himself.
"Up there!"
Fernando pointed, and Harrigan turned. It was actually a perfect spot. A partially shielded small balcony above one of the few semi-solid buildings on the hill. Some sort of residence just north and around the bend from them. Harrigan nodded.
"Good eye, thanks,"
and led the way. As they rounded the bend, through a break between shanties and trees, Harrigan watched as the ground exploded at a drug dealer's feet and the man fell screaming, his body shaking as red holes appeared up his legs, his AK-47 letting off a continuous stream as he fell. The acrid smoke combined with burning thatch and stucco in a cloud that made Harrigan's eyes water as it passed over him. Behind him, Fernando squinted and coughed.
"I love the smell of gunfire in the morning,"
he quipped, clearly evoking the famous Robert Duvall line from Apocalypse Now.
"Napalm,"
Harrigan muttered as he climbed a stepped stone wall up toward the house with the balcony and headed for stairs leading up the side.
"It was napalm."
"Ah,"
Fernando said.
"Yes, I don't know what is napalm."
"Nasty shit,"
Harrigan replied.
"I hope you never will."
The 7 feet of steps led to a landing covered by thatched roofing, and then another enclosed, winding staircase that led up to the short balcony. Harrigan examined his weapons and ammo as he climbed. He had to hit the predator, and hit it fast, before the alien spotted his position. Surprise was key, as much as focus, and staying ahead of the alien. As Harrigan set up his shot, 3 more drug dealers fell, chests and heads exploding from their deadly foe's precision targeting. Only one had a mouth left to scream as he fell, and the 3 companions left standing were panicked, eyes wide and darting about like raving animals now, their attempts at returning fire a mere waste of bullets. Harrigan looked around. Fernando had disappeared. Where was he? He shook it off. No time to worry about him now. The rooftop where the predator stood erupted with fire from a screaming Garber then, and splotches of green appeared as the alien was apparently hit. Harrigan heard an alien scream. Garber cackled.
"Take that, you alien fuck!"
Seconds later, his face froze as an alien missile finally found its mark and blew his legs apart. What was left of him screamed as he fell, and a red laser lit up his head just before it exploded. Harrigan had the alien in his scope when it uncloaked, clearly intent on gathering trophies. It hopped down from its perch to the plaza and headed for the nearest fallen prey, chittering. Harrigan's hand moved toward the trigger when the alien whirled and their eyes met. He saw a recognition there, the alien muttering a strange word.
Umansetanu.
Its shoulder cannon shifted, taking aim. Harrigan jerked, his focus back to his scope, when he heard a strange yell, almost like a southern rebel yell, but with faster syllables. Then below, someone began pelting the uncloaked alien with coconuts, pineapples, and, were those lemons or oranges? Shouting insults in Portuguese. Then Fernando appeared, fruit strapped to bands on his body like ammo pouches, the Brazilian screaming as he ran.
Shoot him, man!
Harrigan couldn't believe his eyes. Fernando was performing the role of his life, and though the audience was limited, he was going to play it out like his life depended on it, which it did. While Harrigan raced to high ground, Fernando observed all the other players in the show getting their heads blown off. Splat! It didn't take long to do the math. Fernando had survived many shootings and riots because when the scream started, civilians ran around in blind panic. Even at 9 years of age, Fernando had recognized that those people made themselves targets, like a flock of birds primed for the shooting. While they flapped around, he would slip away unharmed amidst the raging melee. His action hero was going to get blown up because there were no more birds left to distract the big bad. If Harrigan was blasted away, so would Fernando's hopes of surviving, as well as his dreams of moving to the City of Angels. Ducking away, he found an abandoned fruit cart. Nimbly, he used the nets from the cart to arm himself with coconuts, oranges, and whatever else until he resembled a fruit-strapped Rambo. Then he rushed back into the battle, positioning himself opposite Harrigan to divide the monster's focus.
Hey, you big ugly!
Fernando taunted in Portuguese, chucking another coconut.
You look ridiculous in that net bodysuit. Don't you know that only looks good with boots and a miniskirt? Are you into bondage and domination, or are you just not over the 80s?
The monster cocked its head, and though its features were practically alien, its human eyes shone a disbelief that mirrored Harrigan's stunned face from where he was perched. As its shoulder laser cannon pivoted to aim at Fernando, he ran and screamed,
"Shoot him, man!"
A shot echoed. Fernando winced, resisting the urge to cover his ears and hit the deck. He kept his eyes open long enough to watch green goop spurt from the monster's left shoulder as Harrigan's bullet hit its mark. Without wasting a second, the monster dropped and rolled, disappearing from sight as it vanished once more. Still chucking fruits in the direction where the monster had disappeared, Fernando suddenly felt very exposed in the open space.
"Move your ass, Fernando!"
Harrigan cried, already on his feet to find new cover. With a surprised eek, Fernando ducked down an alleyway, coming face to face with Harrigan a minute later, who reared up with surprise at Fernando's quick appearance.
"Honeycomb!"
Fernando explained again, panting with fear. Harrigan barely slowed down.
"He's bleeding, which means he's leaving a trail."
Nodding, Fernando ignored his shaky knees and followed. Mustering all his confidence, he added,
"I wonder if the punk feels lucky."
Harrigan threw him a strange glance as they raced towards the rooftop where they'd last spotted the creature.
"Like Clint Eastwood,"
Fernando added insistently.
"That is us. We are the Clints."
Yeah, I get it,"
Harrigan grumbled, not wanting to play along.
"We need to get to those guns down there."
Harrigan pointed to where the crazy man had got himself blown to bloody bits.
"But..."
Fernando protested in a whine.
"I already got you guns. You have all the guns."
"Not the right ones."
Harrigan shook his head.
"I got lucky. Garber almost got the upper hand, and we need the same kind of firepower."
With an exasperated sigh, Fernando grumbled as he turned around to backtrack down to where the firepower was.
"I give you guns, but no, you want crazy man guns."
As they wound their way down the favela, they had to take care not to trip over the bodies. Half of the bodies were scalped, and two skinless bodies swayed sickeningly overhead. Fernando daintily touched his lips, fighting his gorge. He'd never seen such indescribable evil.
"He isn't taking time to retrieve his trophies," Harrigan grimaced. "We've got him on the run."
Opting to stay back, Fernando pointed to the landing, where garbers, intestines, and fleshy bits littered the surrounding area like gory confetti. Harrigan rushed ahead, shedding the guns Fernando cleverly found him before, opting for two large firearms, soaked in dead man's blood. From what Fernando could tell, it didn't look like those things shot bullets. Screams resounded in the distance.
"Come with me if you want to be living,"
Fernando called to Harrigan, knowing exactly where the screams originated. Harrigan shouted after Fernando,
"If you want to live."
Tossing a quick look back, Fernando said,
"Of course I want to live. I want to go living in the City of Angels."
Fernando didn't understand Harrigan's snort of anger, but whipped by shanties to the east side of the favela. Something wet dripped onto Fernando's head. Slowing to wipe it off, his eyes widened as he saw it was the same fluorescent green gloop that had jettisoned out of the creature. Harrigan came to a full stop and looked up.
"He's running the roofs."
"Do you know if this can wash?"
Fernando asked, lip curling, dismayed to find the shoulder of his poor blouse had also been dripped on. Harrigan didn't answer. He was busy trying to heft himself up onto the roof by gripping the edge and pulling himself up. The idea was better than its execution. Shaking his head, Fernando critiqued his performance.
"You're too old for that shit."
Sweating and shaking with exertion, Harrigan's head whipped around to shoot Fernando a nasty look.
"Thanks,"
Harrigan reluctantly groused. With a sigh, Fernando dragged over a nearby table, climbed on it where it was a medium step from there onto the rusting metal roof. Reaching down, he gave Harrigan a hand up.
"Look."
The cop pointed at the roof, where the green blood visibly glowed, and led towards the east end toward where Harrigan and the Rio detectives had entered the favela. Running the roofs made for a fast trail, though they had to take care where they stepped so not to fall through the rotting or rusted roofs.
"Dios mío, Judy,"
Fernando muttered, praying as he ran. They stopped abruptly when, three roofs down, a ratty-looking carioca struggled in the creature's grasp. The carioca's handgun slid off the roof and away. The creature, no longer cloaked, cocked his arm back, jagged blades attached from his wrist jutting out past his hand, about to make the killing blow. Fernando gasped, and the monster jerked around. Meeting eyes with pure evil itself, Fernando froze. Even his heart seemed to stop. He barely registered the small cannon mounted on its shoulder, redirecting aim at him.
"Fernando!"
Harrigan yelled, prompting him to look down at his chest, where three red laser dots were trained. Harrigan pushed Fernando to the side with tremendous force, at the same time a bright blue laser beam shot from the shoulder cannon. Fernando screamed as fire burned his left shoulder with such intensity he burst into tears, praying to God that he wasn't ready to die. Smacking hard onto his back, somehow managing not to slide down and off its edge, Fernando saw Harrigan had propelled himself in the opposite direction, avoiding the creature's shot. Gasping, Fernando managed to get out.
"Go ahead, make his day,"
hoping his action hero could save them. A stream of bullets exploded from below, and Harrigan heard voices shouting orders, even before he saw the Brazilian detectives, Rios and Vilaça, firing their rifles as they directed other police and armed civilians to where the alien stood atop the roof. Harrigan scrambled to his feet after verifying that Fernando was only shot in the shoulder. He'd live. At least, he had as good a shot as any of them did to get out alive. The alien emitted a piercing growl as bullets struck its uninjured arm and shoulder, sending more glowing green blood trailing down its body. Sparks and electrical streaks ran across its armor, indicating something important had been damaged. It stabbed the captive carioca it held firm in its grasp, even as it turned to run, hurling the corpse with its inhuman strength toward the firing humans to provide a distraction and block their aim. Bullets tore up the roof beneath its pounding feet as it ran. Down below, a blonde, bulky tourist in a flowery shirt Harrigan recognized grabbed his short, round wife by the arm and yanked her away just as the carioca's corpse landed right where she'd been standing.
"Son of a bitch, almost hit my pebbles!"
The man screamed and opened fire with an LI-547B1, one of the crazy futuristic cannons Garber had been demonstrating. The rooftop where the alien had once stood exploded, shattering clay tiles, stucco, and wood flying into splinters.
Calma, amigo! We need to find him again!
Rios called, shaking her head as her eyes and her partners searched for the alien. Harrigan used the distraction to pull Fernando back to his feet.
Get behind me, Harrigan instructed. You want to go to the City Angels, right? Stay sharp.
What is a pebbles?
Fernando mumbled, still trying to wrap his mind around the idea he might live.
Below, two SWAT-type vans pulled up, lights flashing, and armed men with body armor poured out, setting up a firing line behind the two detectives.
Do you see him?
Vilasa called, spotting Harrigan. Harrigan shook his head and cupped his mouth.
He can cloak. Stay ready and shoot for the head and upper body.
If they hit him enough times there, the beast would falter, maybe even die. All it took was one good shot, Harrigan remembered from decades before. Back then, it had taken a lot more, but now they had much better weapons with computer targeting. With a thumping crash, the Predator landed down below, mandibles flaring, and ran across another rooftop, struggling with its control panel as it went. Harrigan suddenly realized the alien couldn't cloak.
There!
He yelled, and aimed the grenade launcher he'd retrieved from Garber at the alien, letting the targeting system beep, even as he shut off the safety and fingered the trigger. He launched two grenades at once, before taking off at a run again, Fernando staggering, but close on his heels. The Predator almost made it off the roof to another when the grenades hit, blowing up the ground beneath its feet. As it leaped into the air, trying to minimize damage, and whirled toward a nearby tree, trails of automatic gunfire flowed through the air all around it. Harrigan thought for sure it would be hit multiple times, but it landed with barely a grunt and glared back at him, then scanned the area below where the police and armed civilians had formed a line, assessing its options. Harrigan lined it up in his sights again, preparing to use the second grenade launcher's contents. Automatic fire tore up the edges of the roof, but the Predator was at an angle where the police and civilians couldn't see much of it from the ground, as their fire tore up the edges of the roof and the ceramic tiles and thatch, doing the alien no harm.
Thunder, Zintikai!
The Predator shouted, raising its chin in defiance, back arched, mandibles flared, as it typed furiously on its wrist control.
Oh, shit!
Harrigan yelled, realizing what that meant. The bomb. It was arming the bomb.
Run!
He called to Fernando, even as he took off to put distance between himself and the alien. Then the air shimmered ahead, and four Predators appeared, spears in hand, eyes narrowed with determination, mandibles flaring, and marched toward him.
Meu Deus, we die!
Fernando exclaimed, shrinking back and halting his steps, uncertain. He cradled his wounded arm, fear shining in his eyes. The lead Predator stopped and locked eyes with Harrigan, saying,
Not talk, Uman.
It raised its hand, holding a 3D cube of glass or some composite metal, and aimed it at Harrigan. Harrigan stopped running and prepared to dodge. Fuck. What was it? Some new weapon? Then the cube flashed, and an image appeared. A picture of the Predator who'd been attacking the favela. His markings, clear, bright, bold words in the alien tongue above and below. The layout resembled a wanted poster. The lead alien nodded.
Tarai Hassan,
it said, and all three of the other Predators stared with contempt at their injured comrade, mandibles clicking rapidly as they emitted some kind of rumbling clicking, a form of laughter mixed with contempt, Harrigan thought. The injured alien growled, staring at them with almost challenge for a moment, then lowering its head and eyes, as if in surrender. And the cube went dark again.
Harrigan, get down!
Rios called, as Harrigan looked back to see the police and civilian line redistributing themselves to positions where all four Predators were in range. Harrigan turned and raised a hand.
No, wait!
His eyes met Rios's.
Are you crazy? There's more! We can take them!
Vilasa shouted. But Rios suddenly understood and nodded to Harrigan.
Hold your fire!
Harrigan sighed and turned back to the Predators, nodding.
He's all yours.
The Predator's search party quickly surrounded their wounded comrade, stripping away his weapons and securing him with some sort of restraints, then grabbing him by the arms to lift him. Two whirled him around and led him back toward where they'd appeared, up the hill near the remains of some shacks. The lead Predator clicked, mandibles crossed, and nodded to Harrigan. It looked almost like respect.
Landa Syndicae,
the alien said warmly, as with great respect.
Landa Syndicae.
Harrigan did his best to repeat back and nodded. With that, the lead alien raised a palm in salute, then whirled and followed its comrades, all four soon disappearing, as if fading into a mist, only the air was filled with smoke and debris instead. Harrigan turned back to Fernando.
You okay?
Fernando nodded weakly, bleeding heavily, but keeping conscious.
What happened?
He was wanted, a criminal, Harrigan explained. Wanted by us, for sure,
Vilasa said as he and Rios hurried up the hill to stand beside Harrigan and Fernando.
His own will punish him in their way,
Harrigan explained, realizing his understanding was more intuitive. He hadn't understood the words, but somehow the meaning still reached him. Rios glanced around them at what was left of the ruined favela.
What a mess, she said, shaking her head. Think they'd fix this?
Harrigan laughed.
I think the rest is up to us.
Fernando grinned, hopeful.
So, now you take me to City of Angels?
Harrigan grunted.
Are you sure you want to leave all this excitement behind?
All three Brazilians laughed.
Just a normal day in Rio, amigo.
Fernando laughed, but it soon turned into a wet cough. He crossed himself.
If only that was a lie,
Rios added. Harrigan joined them then in laughing.
Let's get you some help, hero,
Harrigan said, clapping Fernando on his good shoulder as ambulances began joining the other vehicles at the base of the favela. Fernando beamed proudly, and they all started down the hill together.
Recon by Dayton Ward. Quang Tri Province, Vietnam. January 1968. Sergeant Daniel Roland ducked and sprinted to his left, bullets chewing into the mud behind him. He threw himself against the trunk of a wide tree, forcing himself to take slow, deliberate breaths. M16 and AK-47 rifle fire pierced the air around him, punctuated by the occasional bark of the shotgun carried by his teammate, John Coffrin. Cries of pain erupted from somewhere over Roland's shoulder, and he shifted his position for a better look. Voices to his right indicated where members of his team were reacting to the ambush, seeking whatever meager cover they could find. Two figures scrambled behind a fallen tree to his right, and he saw the barrel of Coffrin's shotgun as the other man angled for another shot. A native of northern Maryland, the young Marine had been a shotgun aficionado his entire life, and preferred it to an M16, which was fine with Roland. At close range, the Remington 870 in Coffrin's hands could be devastating, and Charlie was plenty close. Roland, you okay? The shout from Coffrin drew fire from the jungle somewhere to Roland's right. Pushing his soft-brimmed jungle hat farther back on his head, he aimed his M16 in that direction and emptied the rifle's magazine, uncertain as to whether his rounds were finding any targets. Feeling the weapon's bolt locked to the rear, he ducked back behind the tree. I'm good, he shouted, dropping the spent mag and fishing a replacement from the pouch on his equipment harness. He jammed the new magazine home and chambered around. Shifting his position for a better look, he scanned the bush in search of threats and gave thanks to the hillside at their backs. That would reduce the likelihood of ambushes slipping in behind them, and they'd already cleared the bunker hidden there, so no surprises would be coming from that direction. Still, Roland knew the longer the firefight dragged on, the better the chances of Charlie getting reinforcements. The repeating metallic snap of an AK-47 on full auto erupted from the undergrowth somewhere very close, and Roland crouched lower as several rounds chewed into the other side of his tree. Scotty, how about it? Rather than say anything, Lance Corporal Scott Pearson pushed himself to a kneeling position behind the fallen tree and fired his M79 at something Roland couldn't see. The hefty round of buckshot tore through the jungle foliage, along with any soft bodies that happened to be in the way. Now we're talking. Hearing yells of alarm in the wake of the shot, Roland aimed his M16 toward the voices, unloading another magazine. Coffrin added his shotgun, and someone else, either Bill Leisner or the team's leader, Lieutenant Matthew Byrne, was firing their own rifle. New cries and what sounded like terrified shrieks burst from the nearby jungle, followed by a wave of intense, sustained weapons fire. Roland hunkered down behind his tree, but after several seconds he realized none of the fire seemed aimed in their direction. What the hell? To his right, Coffrin and Pearson rose from behind the massive log that was their makeshift shelter, aiming their weapons toward the source of the gunfire. Pearson let loose with another buckshot round from the M79. With practiced ease and confidence, Pearson dropped the spent shell from the grenade launcher, replacing it with another round in quick fashion, while Coffrin provided covering fire. Then Coffrin recoiled, dropping to the ground as something bright and yellow-green tore through the underbrush and slammed into Pearson. There was time for Roland to register that the shot, whatever it was, passed completely through the other man before the grenadier lurched backward. Pearson's arms flailed as he fell to the ground. "Scotty!" Shouting toward his friend, Roland divided his attention between Pearson and Coffrin, scanning the tree line, looking for the source of the shot, but saw nothing. Further back in the jungle, he still heard frantic cries and AK-47s firing as though in every direction. Then, everything went quiet. No gunfire, no voices, nothing. The abrupt, surreal change was enough to make Roland and Coffrin exchange befuddled looks. Shrugging, Roland moved from behind the tree, his M16 leading the way. Coffrin mimicked his teammate's actions while making his way to the fallen Pearson, who lay in an awkward sprawl, his rucksack arching his back. Beyond them, Roland saw Corporal Bill Leisner rise from where he'd been lying prone in a small depression. Damp mud and a few leaves clung to his dirty uniform. "Where the hell did everybody go?" asked Leisner. Unable to answer, Roland simply shook his head. "Pearson's dead," reported Coffrin, gesturing down to the body of their friend. "Don't ask me how." That was obvious to Roland even from where he stood. The man's eyes were open in a fixed expression of shock, and the wound in the center of his chest, surrounded by blood and blackened skin and muscle tissue, was at least as big as his fist. Cradling his M16, Leisner stepped around the other two Marines. "Where's Byrne?" For the first time, Roland realized he hadn't seen or heard Lieutenant Byrne since the beginning of the skirmish.
"Sweep the area! Find him!"
From his vantage point, camouflaged within the thick canopy of the tree branches high above the ground, Nakmechi watched the final movements of the fierce skirmish, taking place far below him. The two groups, one far outnumbered by the other, had ceased firing their weapons, and the larger contingent moved deeper into the jungle, its numbers greatly reduced both as a consequence of the fight as well as his own influence. Heat signatures generated by the bodies of the combatants and picked up by his biomask's visual sensors told Nakmechi that the smaller cluster of fighters now numbered 3. They had survived the clash with their enemy on the ground, though 2 had fallen to him, along with several others from the larger group. In truth, he could have taken all of the combatants with little effort, but there was no sport in that. Besides, a simple hunt was not the purpose of his visit. That might come later, provided the current circumstances didn't change to any significant degree. He regarded the skull in his hand, still covered with blood and remnants of tissue from his quarry's body. Cleaning and polishing it prior to adding it to his small yet growing trophy collection would have to wait. Only with great reluctance did he set aside the skull, perching it atop a branch just above his head. As for the others he had taken, Nukmechi disliked the notion of leaving them for the local animal life to consume. He would return for his trophies before departing this world, if at all possible. With slow, deliberate movements, Nukmechi checked the wounds he had sustained while on the ground. Removing his left hand from his side, he saw that the bleeding there was slowing. Despite his cloak, he was unable to avoid being injured by the human's projectile weapons. Vital organs appeared to have been missed, but the injuries to his torso and leg still required attention, if for no other reason than to prevent infection. His leg injury would be simple to treat, if painful, but he would need to remove the projectile from his midsection. His movements might be hampered in the short term, though it was nothing he could not endure. His equipment was another matter. The power cell for his cloak had also been hit, and now the shroud only operated in intermittent fashion. Continuing to use it in its damaged state might draw more attention than if he simply moved without it, so Nukmechi opted to deactivate it. From this elevation, he could escape detection with greater ease, but attempting to stalk the humans would prove problematic. On the other hand, this new limitation would increase the challenge as he carried out his mission. It was not Nukmechi's first visit to this planet. Many cycles ago, as a young, unblooded Yautja, he had accompanied his father and older sibling to hunt. The choice of location was altogether different in both terrain and temperature, and the indigenous weapons and technologies had been somewhat less advanced. As now, though, the humans tracked and killed during that previous hunt were caught up in the grips of their own conflict, albeit on a much larger scale in terms of numbers and the level of wanton violence and destruction. The hunting had been fruitful, with the three Yautja bringing back numerous trophies and other mementos to mark the occasion. For this excursion, Nukmechi traveled alone for the first time, as was customary for blooded hunters. Preliminary scouting reports of the escalating conflict on this world had drawn much interest, and many Yautja were clamoring for the chance to revisit such fertile hunting grounds. The opportunity offered by his clan to investigate this region of the planet was one he could not ignore, and to do so on his own would also be viewed as something of a test. Based on the observations made since his arrival, Nukmechi concluded that while the invading force was better equipped and possessed armaments and vehicles not shared by its adversary, the combatants who seemed to be guardians of this region were defending it well. There were indications of influence and assistance by yet another contingent, which also wielded better weapons and technology. But their role appeared limited and confined to areas well away from here. Nukmechi guessed that situation might change, depending on how long this conflict persisted. It would be fascinating to observe, he decided. For now, the defending force seemed well suited to the battle it faced. Nukmechi guessed that a familiarity with the terrain was at the heart of the advantages these warriors enjoyed. While observing their movements, he discovered a network of underground tunnels and passages, which seemed to be all but unknown to the invaders. The tactic was noteworthy, in that it allowed the defenders to transport personnel and materiel through the unforgiving jungle almost without detection, and at speeds greater than their counterparts. It was not a true equalizer in the grand scheme of things, but it served to make things interesting. As for the invaders, they appeared reliant on their superior weapons and equipment, almost to a fault. They infiltrated enemy areas of this vast, unrelenting jungle in small numbers, using their primitive airborne conveyances to transport combatants from secure locations to these remote areas. They moved with relative stealth, as though conducting reconnaissance of their own. Perhaps they were gathering information for later use by a larger force, with a more conventional goal of securing territory and resources. This made sense from a strategic perspective, But only time would bear out such a theory. Time Nokmichi did not possess. Below him, the humans from the smaller group were gathering around the remains of their comrades, doubtless attempting to deduce what had happened. It had been a simple matter for Nokmichi to identify the leader of each group and remove them from the equation, allowing the remaining combatants to process and adjust to the change in status quo, so that he could study their reactions. This activity was not a component of his mission parameters, but remained within the acceptable sphere of deviation. Such opportunity could not be forsaken, particularly if it provided valuable insights about the object of a hunt. What would they do now? Staring down at the corpse, it took Roland an extra moment to ensure himself that he was in fact looking at the remains of his patrol leader, Matthew Byrne. The brass bracelet on the lieutenant's right wrist, a gift crafted from old shell casings by a Montagnard villager, was a better identifier for Byrne than the man's own face, which was all but unrecognizable, owing to the complete lack of a skull. It, along with the entire spine, appeared to have been cut or pulled out by some measure of force. How was that even possible? Blood was everywhere, dark red and glistening after having drained from Byrne's body to stain his uniform and equipment. The stench of loosened bowels and bladder was almost overpowering, and Roland forced himself to breathe through his mouth. Reaching for the M16 lying on the ground next to the lieutenant's right hand, he inspected the weapon. He never got off the first shot. He ejected the full magazine, sticking it in the pocket of his drab green uniform blouse. "The gooks did this?" asked Corporal Bill Leisner, who along with Roland served as one of the team's riflemen. Roland heard the uncertainty and fear in the other Marine's voice. "Who else?" Even as he asked the question, Roland shook his head. "What I don't get is how. We were out of each other's line of sight for what, a minute?" Unable to look away from Byrne's mutilated form, he instead studied the extensive damage inflicted upon the lieutenant's body. John Coffran had been the one to find him, nearly 20 meters from where Roland was standing when the ambush came, along with the bizarre sequence of events accompanying it, which resulted in the deaths of Scotty Pewson, and, it seemed, Lieutenant Byrne. "What I want to know is why they ran," said Coffran. "You heard them, right? Something spooked the shit out of them." Roland nodded. In addition to Byrne's body, the team had found 8 dead Viet Cong soldiers sprawled in the jungle. The positions of their bodies indicated not all of them had died as a result of the recon team's return fire during the attack. 4 were killed some distance from where Leisner determined the ambush was set, and one of those had died in a manner similar to Pearson, with a massive wound punched through the center of his chest. "What the hell does that kind of damage?" "We can't stay here," said Coffran. "The pricks we didn't shoot will be back, and they'll have friends." Glancing past the other Marine, Roland studied the bunker set into the side of the sloping hill. All but invisible in the thick jungle undergrowth, the hideaway was a shelter built from tree branches and other broadleaf vegetation designed to let the structure blend into its surroundings. So effective was the bunker's camouflage that the recon team's point man, Leisner, almost tripped over the damn thing. It was an unexpected find, yielding nothing of use or potential value, although the ambush was enough to prove that Charlie must have known they would be here to investigate. This was enough to make Roland nervous, especially in light of their mission to find any evidence of a prisoner of war camp somewhere in this stretch of the Kwong Tri province's northern boundary. Rumors about such a camp had circulated off and on for months, with nothing to back them up, and the issue was set aside as more pressing matters demanded the attention of recon teams. Things only heated up again when it became known that the son of a prominent United States senator was an Air Force pilot shot down somewhere near the demilitarized zone. If a POW camp existed in this area, it would be a logical place to take the pilot, assuming he was even still alive. Familiar enough with the region, both from studying charts and photos, as well as time spent surveying it on the ground and in the air. Roland was confident no camp was here. Regardless, orders were orders, and it had been with a degree of renewed urgency that his team was dispatched to investigate. Unlike typical force recon patrols, this outing was planned as a short hop-and-pop into the area, with a 5-man team to keep things light, fast, and mobile. 48 hours on the ground after a near-dawn insertion to validate or refute the intel about the POW camp, and then out, hopefully without attracting enemy attention. The plan lasted the better part of 36 hours before going to shit, as Byrne and Pearson could testify. "Remind me to cock-punch those S2 assholes when we get back," said Coughran. "They said this place was supposed to be quiet." Roland grunted in agreement. The team's pre-mission intelligence briefing indicated no significant enemy activity or movement in the area, an assertion which had gone up in smoke. Now the question was, to what degree that intel was incorrect. "If those guys were part of a larger force," he said, "then we're in some right deep shit." Coughran replied, "Neck deep, and with raging hemorrhoids." He was busying himself with finding room in his rucksack and pockets for the extra magazines he now held. Both he and Roland, along with Leisner, had divided the remaining ammunition carried by Byrne and Pearson. Coughran had taken the extra step of burying the dead men's weapons and other equipment that was of no further use. "I think we got lucky," said Roland. "If they really knew we were coming and had time to plan, they'd have set up a larger ambush and cut us to shit." The Viet Cong were notorious for their ambush tactics, which involved elaborate setups that took into account everything from weather to terrain, and involved recon and tracking activities which might take hours, and even days, to bring to fruition, as they prepared to attack a targeted force. However, that did not rule out a smaller contingent performing its own recon patrol, and simply taking advantage of time and opportunity to carry out its own ambush. "Maybe we spooked them, but next time, they'll have our asses. We need to get gone, now." Removing his boonie hat, Roland wiped sweat from his face. Even with the relatively cool January temperatures, the jungle was still hot and humid. "Too bad we can't call for a ride." Despite Roland's misgivings, none of the team even carried a radio in accordance with their orders. Their mission called for such stealth that in the minds of those calling the shots back at HQ, even the risk of monitored communications carried too much risk. Of course, that ruled out calling for helicopter extraction ahead of the prearranged rendezvous time and location. Like the others, Roland had memorized that information rather than marking it on the map he carried in his pocket, in the event he was captured or killed and the map found by enemy soldiers. He knew he could navigate with his map and compass to the landing zone. They just had to get there by the scheduled time. If for some reason they failed to make that rendezvous, there was a backup time and LZ location. After that, they were screwed. "So let's start hoofing." "Guys," said Leisner, who was standing several yards away, "check this out." Strapping Pearson's M79 and bandolier of remaining grenades across his back, Roland moved with Coughran to join their companion. Roland was the first to see what had drawn the other Marine's attention. It was the body of yet another Vietnamese soldier, killed in a manner similar to Pearson and the other Cong. The corpse lay face down, with the muddy ground visible through the hole in his torso. Coughran frowned. "One of you guys packing a rocket launcher you didn't tell me about?" "He may have been the leader," said Roland, kneeling next to the body and indicating the canvas satchel slung across its left shoulder. After verifying the bag wasn't booby-trapped, he removed it from the dead soldier and opened it. Papers comprised most of the contents, along with a pair of maps, which he handed to Leisner. "Holy shit," said the other Marine, after a minute studying the find. "This is a map of the province and the surrounding area. Look what's marked." The faster he talked, the more his distinctive upper Midwest inflections asserted themselves. leaning for a closer look, Roland recognized several terrain features, as well as Vietnamese and American military bases in proximity to the demilitarized zone. He couldn't help but note the lines drawn toward U.S.-controlled locations, such as Dong Ha, Da Nang, and Quan Tri City, along with numerous others across South Vietnam. "What are these figures supposed to be?" asked Coffrin. Leisner shrugged. "I think it's code." The group's designated translator, he could speak and read Vietnamese, including several of the trickier dialects. After a moment, the Marine's eyes widened. "Damn, I think this might be an attack plan."
"Where?" asked Roland.
"Everywhere." Leisner stabbed the map. "This looks like a major offensive." Coffrin asked.
"When?"
"Don't know. Nothing here indicates a date or time. Could it be for the attacks they just pulled?"
The memories of the recent rocket and mortar assault on Quang Tri base and other American targets just days earlier, prior to their departure for this mission, were still fresh in Roland's mind. Leisner shook his head.
"This looks bigger than all of that. A lot bigger." "We take it with us." Roland gestured with his satchel toward the map. "Somebody smarter than us can figure it out when we get back." He checked his watch. "We've got about 12 hours to make it to the LZ. Let's get the hell out of here."
The three humans were walking into a trap. Looking high above the jungle floor, and using both the now-fading darkness and the thick tree canopy for concealment, Nkmechi watched the genesis of the attack as it evolved. The sensors in his biomask showed him the heat signatures of the 12 bodies maneuvering into position, well away from the narrow rail that wound through the undergrowth, for some distance, toward a larger, wider path used by ground vehicles. In another direction, he observed that the jungle gave way to a large, relatively clear area dominated by high grass. Based on his observation of the smaller group's progress through the region, Nkmechi suspected that glade might well be a location designated for retrieval by one of their airborne vehicles. With fascination, he observed this larger force's inspection of the area, working as if to anticipate the course being charted by the interlopers, before assuming positions within the thick foliage. The group had decided on a straightforward arrangement of the individual combatants, with a portion of them directing their weapons toward the approach vector they expected their adversaries to utilize. The balance of the group was arrayed along what should be a flank, assuming the targets followed their current path through the undergrowth. It was a tactic not that dissimilar from schemes Nkmechi utilized as a young unblooded Yautja, learning the ways of the hunt on the homeworld under his father's tutelage. Those schemes were designed to stalk and kill large game animals, though experience taught him they were useful against more intelligent quarry as well. Such appeared to be the case here. Nkmechi shifted his position, adjusting his biomask's visual sensors to increase their magnification. The trio of invaders was now visible, unknowingly making their way toward the site of the coming ambush. He had trailed their progress throughout the previous day, until they settled into a defensive position as darkness fell. Only then had he detected the presence of the enemy force. The three now were charting a course running parallel to the established jungle trail, which allowed them to utilize the undergrowth for concealment. They were not charting a direct path for the glade, but their only logical reason for being in this area, based on their past behavior, was a rendezvous just after daylight. Though they moved with stealth and alertness, they appeared to have no idea what awaited them. If all went according to plan, the attackers would be able to take their prey with ease. The ambush would be a slaughter. Feeble pre-dawn sunlight filtered through the trees, providing the only illumination. It was sufficient for Roland to make out the ground ahead of him. Moving in a slow, deliberate fashion, he chose each step with care, stopping each time to listen and search for signs of danger. The telltale sounds of insects and even the odd bird filled the air. but otherwise the only thing he heard was his own breathing, which he fought to keep low and regular.
Almost there.
A nerve-wracking day spent traversing the jungle, followed by a defensive watch to get them through the night, had brought them to this point. If his read of the map and compass were correct, they were less than an hour from the primary extraction point.